Okay, we're reading through the miracles of Jesus, and we're still in the first miracle in John chapter 2. John chapter 2. Is this going to work, or do I need to? I'm suffering from some kind of sickness. Why am I here, you ask? Is that your question? Yeah, why am I here? I called in sick yesterday. Robert covered for me, so I guess I could have got you to cover for me today. So this is the miracle of at Cana in Galilee, turning the water into wine. John chapter 2. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. Okay, we'd worked our way through the first paragraph or so, and we got down to the six stone jars that were holding water for Jewish rites of purification, it says. I presume that this is the way I'm visualizing it. These are pretty, they hold 20 or 30 gallons? It's a pretty big jar. I presume that they were out in some kind of area where when the guests arrived for the wedding feast, they could dip a ladle into the big jar and pour it over their hands. I don't envision them poking their hands down in the jar and giving it one of those. I think they would probably dip the water out, pour it over their hands or their feet, and then the wedding guest would be on their way. I guess you have to have a towel, too, maybe. But they're big jars. The Jews had a tradition of washing their hands for purification. I used the word search on my computer and tried to find what this might come from in the Old Testament. And I'm not aware of any requirement in the Law of Moses that the Israelites wash their hands for purification. There are requirements if you become ceremonially unclean that you wash yourself with water, and then you'll be unclean until the sun goes down. In Leviticus chapter 15, the whole chapter, or at least the parts I read of it, dealt with this kind of issue. Now, I have to warn you, if you read Leviticus chapter 15 with your young children, you're going to have some splaining to do. So just be aware. You'll know if you read Leviticus chapter 15. And partway through that, the first verse, Leviticus chapter 15. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean. And a few verses later, and if one with the discharge spits on someone who is clean, he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. And in verse 11, anyone with whom the one with the discharge touches without having rinsed his hands in water shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. I'm not aware of any other passages in the Law of Moses that address this kind of issue. Some of them speak specifically of the priests, but for the general public. And the one that talks about rinsing hands in water, it sounds as if the person who is unclean has to rinse his hands in water before he touches someone else. Otherwise, he'll spread the uncleanness, I suppose. Well, it's easy to see perhaps how this would generate into the practice of ceremonially cleansing yourself, either from something you may have picked up in the marketplace, or from if you're unclean and you don't know it, and you wouldn't want to spread that around. I've got this virus that you can hear in my voice. So I'm unclean, probably. But until about 150 years ago, people would not have recognized that it's a virus, and it can be spread by hand to hand. I don't even know if they knew that 150 years ago. So they weren't thinking in terms of sickness. They were thinking in terms of being unclean. More about this tradition in Mark chapter 7. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him, this is Mark chapter 7, starting in the first verse. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with undefiled hands?" I'm not aware of any Old Testament requirement to go through some kind of ceremonial washing before you eat. But it's easy to see how it would become a tradition. And as a tradition, it seems kind of harmless, I suppose. And matter of fact, you know, you read the list and you think, well, you probably ought to wash your pots and your pans and your cups and your hands routinely. But we're thinking of germs. They didn't know about germs, I don't think. Traditions, though, it seems, are hard to avoid. I think anytime people get together and they do something together, they always, I'm going to say always, you're going to try to find the exception, they usually form a tradition, and they stick with their traditions. If you have somebody you go drink coffee with once a week, you do it the same time every week. You go to the same cafe. You sit in the same booth at the Dairy Queen, wherever it is. You'll form that kind of tradition, and it's pretty much unavoidable. But at some point, they can become bad and distort the commandments of God. Reading on in Mark chapter 7. And he said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.' You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." So we're not going to be able to avoid traditions, but we need to hold them up to Scripture, and we need to be honest about them, try to recognize what's a tradition and what's more important than a tradition, Sometimes somebody will come along and say they don't like our tradition. Well, what they want to do is start another tradition. You know, so you're going to jump out of one pot into another. Maybe the tradition is better. Some traditions are better than other traditions. Now, you may be thinking, well, we don't have any traditions. Well, yeah, we do. We got lots of traditions. I know of churches celebrate the Lord's Supper every week. And when they celebrate the Lord's Supper, they have the table. And behind the table are two elders. And the celebration of the Lord's Supper is the responsibility of the elders. They offer words of encouragement. They say the communion prayers. And then they have helpers come up and distribute. That's perfectly fine. That's a perfectly fine tradition. We don't do that. We don't follow that tradition. We may not have even thought about following that tradition. I know I've been in another church where they devote an hour to the Lord's Supper and in a pretty much unscheduled fashion. And then when it's time to distribute the elements, a person walks to the front, holds the plate, offers thanks for the bread, then hands it to the person on the front row, and they hand it to the person, and it goes down the row, and then they turn and hand it to the person on the next row, and they hand it to the person on the next row, and it winds its way to the back, and then whoever has it in this back corner carries it over here, and it winds its way back down to the front. That's a perfectly good tradition. We don't do it that way, but we could. I don't know if there's any advantage to it, but we could do it that way. See, we have thousands of traditions we don't recognize. Well, maybe not thousands. We got a bunch of traditions. Some of them are good enough. Most of them we never think of. Because when you're living in a tradition, you don't see it as a tradition. That doesn't make it good or bad. That's just a fact. But the Jews had a tradition of washing their hands before they ate. So there was six stone jars of water for the Jewish rites of purification. Jesus said to the servants, this is back in John chapter 2, about verse 6 or 7, fill the jars with water, and they filled them to the brim. Now, the Jews, they were very concerned about this purity, this external purity. Now, one of the bad things about this kind of tradition is not only are you concerned that you yourself are pure, but it's pretty easy to be concerned that everybody else at the party sees you washing your hands, so they know that you're pure. It's easy. That happens, and I think that's probably what has happened in this time as well. Jesus said, fill the jars with water. I know they didn't use the hose because they didn't have hoses. 20 or 30 gallons of water weighs a good 200 pounds, and you put the weight of the jar. I don't know if they wanted to carry a 300-pound jar full of water down to the spring, wherever it is, and then back to the house. Or did they put their 3-gallon jugs on their shoulders and fill them up and then carry it and pour it into the big jars? I don't know. But one way or another, they filled up the six stone jars with water. Six times 20, that's either somewhere between 120 and 180 gallons of water. That's a lot of water. Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. So they took it. I don't know who the master of the feast is either. I've read people say it's the head waiter, like the person in charge of distributing food and drink. I don't know if that's true or not. He seems to have kind of a speaking role because he's able to call the bridegroom out and compliment him on the quality of this wine. When the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. So this water now become wine. This is I'm considering this to be an act of creation. I've made my way through a couple of chemistry classes and didn't understand them at all. But I know water is hydrogen and oxygen, and I know wine has a lot of sugars in it, and there's a bunch of carbon. I don't know what the formula is for wine. Had a chemistry teacher once that was, he talked about wine a lot because he was interested in the chemistry of it. But I was just trying to survive the class, so I didn't know. I didn't pick up much from that one. So this is an act of creation inside this big jar, which was formerly water, and at some point becomes wine. And I presume the whole jar becomes wine. Now, the jars contained previously what they used for ceremonial cleansing. Jesus changes it into something else that actually has an effect on people. I think do we have to discuss alcohol? Are we required to discuss alcohol when we come to this passage? Some people, I've heard people twist themselves into a knot, trying to convince themselves and others that there was no alcohol in this wine. I think it's easier just to accept there was alcohol in this wine. Yeah.
Because after they're drunk, they don't know what
they're drinking. Well, I don't know. Yeah, after they got a... They're at least less concerned. Right. Yeah.
And it also says the old wineskins, I've never been drunk, I don't know, I've never drunk, I don't know. Anyway, yeah, it says the old wineskins and the new wineskins, it was bursting, so it wouldn't burst them unless it was...
Alcohol, yeah.
Alcohol,
yeah.
I don't know.
Now... I'll tell you my opinion, and you can throw stones later. I do not believe it is necessary to be a faithful Christian that you abstain from alcohol in everything you drink for your entire life. I don't believe that's necessary. I think I can speak for the elders on this. It is very unwise to make a habit of drinking anything with alcohol in it. There's hardly any upside, and there's a big downside. Am I right about that, elders?
Yep.
Okay. You'd agree? So you're not going to recommend it. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, well, you're now stepping on my toes. Yeah, no, you're stepping on my toes at that. Yeah. There is I failed to look it up, but it's in there somewhere. There is a verse where Jesus says, John the Baptist didn't eat and didn't drink, and you called him crazy. I'm making this part up. I don't remember exactly what they called him. The Son of Man comes eating and drinking, and you call him a glutton and a wine bibber. Is a wine bibber somebody who drinks wine? So Jesus apparently drank the wine at the feast. I think being tempted in all things... Yet without sin, I can say without doubt, Jesus was never drunk from the wine he drank. Yes, I agree. I think it's interesting, though, how many people realized that Jesus had turned the water into wine? The master of the feast Somebody brought him a cup and he drank it. And he said, man, this is the good stuff. Now, my experience is with wine is, if that's the good stuff, spare me for the bad stuff. It's an acquired taste. And you know, if somebody offers me a glass of wine, I'm not gonna throw it at them. I'll sip it and say, man, this is the good stuff. Spare me the bad stuff. I've not acquired the taste. So the master of the feast didn't know about it. So Jesus didn't make, he didn't say, ladies and gentlemen, I'm now going to turn the water into wine. Voila. Like Houdini or whoever the magician is. He didn't do that. It was a very quiet thing. The servant that brought the cup to the master of the feast, he knew where it came from, but he knew he put water in that jug, and now he's handed a cup of it to this guy who says it's good wine, and that's all he knows. This is a pretty, if Jesus is looking to attract a crowd, he's doing it the wrong way. This is not the way to attract a crowd. This is a pretty much a secret kind of sign. But the disciples knew about it. He was there with a number of disciples, probably not 12, but a few, six or so maybe, we would have evidence of. This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, manifesting his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Now that's the purpose of this miracle, that his disciples would believe in him. We'll never get through any miracles if we don't move along to the second miracle, which is in John chapter 4. And to the best of my knowledge, in chronological, well, it's hard to say. If you go back and you read John, the next chapter in John, Jesus talks with Nicodemus, and Nicodemus mentions the signs that Jesus is doing, but I don't know exactly which signs he's referring to. Because we don't have any record of Jesus doing any miracles necessarily at that point, except for changing the water into wine. In John chapter 4, verse 46, well, let's see, 46 to 54. Let me see if I can read that, maybe. Chapter 4. Jesus has gone down to Jerusalem for the Passover, cleansed the temple, talked to Nicodemus, made his way back up through Samaria, had a conversation with a woman at the well. And now in chapter 4, verse 46, so he came again to Cana in Galilee where he had... Yes, sir. Okay, go ahead. You want me to save my voice? Is that what it is?
So he came again to Cana in Galilee where he had made the water and wine. At Capernaum, there was an official whose son was killed. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. The official said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. Jesus said to him, go, your son will live. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. The father knew this was the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live, and he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee.
Thank you. So he's come back to Cana. excuse me. Cana is a village up in the hills. Capernaum was a bigger town down on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. And I understand it's about 25 miles between the two. So if you can walk 2.5 miles an hour, which is a pretty good pace for all day long, uphill, it's about a 10-hour walk from Capernaum up to Cana. Now, maybe he had a horse. I don't know. Did people ride horses or did they walk? I tried to, so I Googled, how fast can you move on a donkey? And it turns out that donkeys are great pack animals, but they kind of go at their own pace. So, you know, if you want to load, if you want to carry a bunch of heavy stuff, the donkey's your animal. But if you're just riding yourself, you know, you can ride the donkey, but you're going to go at the donkey's pace, which is what that guy in the Old Testament found when the angel stopped the donkey. You know, there you go. That's what happens with donkeys. So I'm presuming they're walking. Now, again, I'm always confused when Jesus has a conversation with somebody. The official has made his way up to Capernaum. Now, news has traveled fast. It's 25 miles. And people in Capernaum are now talking about where Jesus is. You know, and you know, they don't have cell phones. And they don't have, he wasn't updated on Facebook. This has had to be word of mouth. That would take a while. And this official who has a very sick son, who can see that he's going to die soon, decides to go ask Jesus to make him well. Now, does he know that Jesus can do this kind of thing? Or is he just presuming he's heard of the water turned into wine? And now he's presuming, well, if he can do that, he can make my son well. I presume. So he's walked up to Cana, and he asked, says to Jesus, he asked him to come down and heal his son, for he's at the point of death. And Jesus responds, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. I'm confused by this. Was that for the official's benefit? He wasn't there to see a sign and a wonder. He had something he really needed. He needed somebody to take care of his son. He's showing a lot of concern. Well, he's showing a parent's concern for his son. I don't know that it's extraordinary, but he's not there to test Jesus or to make a fuss. He's there for this very important need. So I'm taking that to Jesus saying this statement for the benefit of the bystanders. Because the official just repeats, sir, come down before my child dies. And Jesus said to him, go, your son will live. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. Is he somehow assured that his son will live? Well, he believes the word of Jesus. And that's all he has. Now, how many people knew about this sign? The man himself, the official himself, didn't really know that day. Since it's, you know, if it takes a full day of travel to get from Capernaum up to Cana, so day one, the guy walks up to Cana. Day two, he talks to Jesus. Day three, he starts back down to Cana, and halfway down, I suppose, something like that, he meets his servants coming back up, walking up to Cana to retrieve him, saying his son was recovering. And he asked them, well, when did he get better? And they said, seventh hour, which I'm taking to be, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then he realized, well, that's the time I was talking to Jesus yesterday. Again, if Jesus is trying to attract a crowd with miracles, he's doing it the wrong way, because he's doing the miracles, first of all, at a 25-mile distance. It's hard to generate much enthusiasm over a 25-mile distance. And the people who would know, you really don't know that the miracle occurred for until, you know, 24 hours after it happened. That would have been, yeah, so, you know. And then the only people who know are on the road halfway between Capernaum and Cana. But they knew. He himself believed, the official believed, and all his household as well. This was the second sign that Jesus did when he came from Judea to Galilee. I have to say, as a miracle worker, Jesus is not doing this in such a way as to attract a crowd so far. So let's look at the next miracle. The next one, I understand, in semi-chronological order, as best as the people can tell whose books I'm reading, is in Luke chapter 5. The first catch of fish. This is Luke, Matthew, Mark, Luke, chapter 5. Starting in the first verse, on one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, that's the Sea of Galilee, as we commonly know it, and he saw two boats by the lake, but the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put him out a little from the land, and he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word I will let down the nets." And when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. They signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And when they came and filled both boats, and they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. So, on one occasion, Jesus has now attracted a crowd of people who want to hear him, hear his teaching. But I think it's interesting, in chapter 5, verse 1, the teaching that Jesus is giving is described as the Word of God. Not Jesus' teaching, not the law of Moses, not the law and the prophets, not the tradition of the elders. It is the Word of God. Just as a practical matter, he sets down and he asks, I suppose, it's Simon's boat, it says somewhere. Puts his, there'd have to be a dock. There's usually a dock. I'm guessing the boat was still tethered to the dock, but it was out some distance from the land, and the people were sitting on the shore and on the dock or wherever they were, and Jesus spoke to them from the boat, just to be able to do that, just as a practical convenience. We may be curious about exactly what he talked about, but Jesus, it appears, was a preacher that moved from place to place. He taught in synagogues, he taught in the open air, and no doubt he taught the same lessons and teachings routinely, because they didn't have microphones. He could only speak to 100 or 1,000 at the moment, probably not 1,000. There's a limited number of people he can speak to, and he taught in a lot of different places. So I'm sure he repeated himself a lot. But I trust that we have recorded in the Gospels the essential part of his teaching and the teaching that we need to meet our needs. So after he finished speaking, he said to Peter, to Simon, "Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word I will let down the nets." This wasn't Peter's idea. He didn't say, "You know, Jesus, if you get in the boat and we go out there and we let down the nets, you could have us catch a big bunch of fish. That'd really be helpful." No, it wasn't Peter's idea. He was finished fishing for the day. He'd been up all night, he said. They'd caught nothing. They'd washed their nets. They had stowed away their gear. And there was going to be no more fishing until the next night, I presume, if they fished always at night. Peter's a bit reluctant as well. You know, we toiled all night and took nothing. But he is obedient. "At your word, I will let down the nets." Now, I noticed when Jesus sat down to teach, the crowd was pressed in on him. They wanted to hear the word of God. And it is this word from Jesus that motivates Peter to be obedient. And I'm presuming he put a good effort into the fishing. He wasn't just lackadaisically throwing out the net just to pacify Jesus. He was fishing with all his skill. And it says, he said, "Push out into the deep." I don't know how far the deep is, but it was far enough that they had to signal back to James and John on the shore to come bring a second boat to help them. So I don't know how far they it was further than you could yell, I suppose. And it would seem it would make sense that a professional fisherman would be able to signal each other. They would know. I don't know what their signals were. I don't know. Semaphore? Anyway. They had signals, hand signals. You know, it could have been one of these. I don't know. But they could, because, you know, they did this for a living, and they communicated across long distances of water every day. So James and John apparently row out there as quickly as they can, and they've caught more fish than they can manage, and it's overloading both boats. And then Peter's response. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." Again, notice, who knew that there had been a miracle performed? Well, there's Peter. I'm presuming he's there with his brother Andrew. They saw the fish start to, as they pulled in their net, they saw the beginning of the fish. Then there was James and John. So, and it's not in front of a crowd. It's far enough out into the lake where the only way to communicate with people is by hand signals. So if anybody's still standing on the crowd, they may see a bunch of commotion out in the sea, out in the lake, but they're not going to know what's going on. Again, if Jesus is trying to attract a crowd with a bunch of miracles, I'm not sure he's doing it right. This is pretty much to a limited number of people. And Peter has the only reasonable response. He realizes that Jesus couldn't do this just merely as a man, and he's reminded of his own sinfulness. They were all astonished and frightened, it said. But Jesus said, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men." Again, this miracle is not for the crowd. It's for the disciples themselves. Let's see. And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. Which makes me wonder, who looked after all these fish? Or did they release what they didn't want. Maybe, I don't know. Turning water into wine is an act of creation. Healing the boy who is sick. I know Jesus could kill the virus from 25 miles away. I guess it was a virus, and who knows what the kid had something that could kill him, though, or at least they thought it would kill him. That is control over nature, I suppose. Then catching the fish, I presume that, I don't know, how did this happen? Did Jesus herd the fish into this one area so that he could herd fish? I don't know. How did that, or the fish created? I don't know. One way or another, he's got control of it. About, that's right. Yeah, he's drawing a parallel. And look how successful you can be catching fish. Just think, be encouraged. You'll be catching men from now on. That's the kind of, that's the point he's attempting to make, or he's making. And I don't know if Peter gets the point right away, because all he can say is, "Depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, O Lord." He might have to think about it for a while. There are, in Matthew and Mark, there are an account of Jesus calling Peter and Andrew and James and John. And I think the accounts in Matthew and Mark sound to me like it's a different occasion. I don't think you can put what you find in Matthew and Mark and mix it with what you find in Luke. I don't think they go together very well. So I think this is a separate occasion. I might be wrong about that, but you can think what you like, I suppose. Matthew chapter 4, starting in verse 18. While walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea. So in this instance, they were actually fishing, apparently from the shore, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." Immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets. And he called them. Immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. So that sounds like a different occasion than what we read in Luke chapter 5. And same incident in Mark chapter 1. Passing alongside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going a little further, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in their boat mending the nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and followed him. I think this is a different occasion than we read of in Luke chapter 5. In Luke chapter 5, Jesus says, "Don't be afraid, from now on you will be catching men." In Matthew and Mark, he says, "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men." Changing their vocation. They were previously fishers of fish, and now they're going to be fishers of men. They will catch men. Okay. Thank you very much.